Okay. Hello, this is Feb Stokes, the podcast series of the Foundation for European Progressive Studies. My name is Laszlo Andor. I'm the Secretary General of FEBS, and I have a distinguished guest today to discuss peace. The guest is Professor Stephen Bronner, who is a professor emeritus at Rutgers University, which is the State University of New Jersey. But Stephen has had a number of important activities. For example, he's a former chair of the U.S. Academics for Peace, and he's also a chair of the Independent Experts Peace Initiative. He's also director of the International Council for Diplomacy and Dialogue in the United States of America, which I think demonstrates that you're not only a man of theory, although you are also a man of political theory, but also you have done your bit in order to promote the idea and the practice of dialogue and peace in the recent decades. So, Stephen, welcome, and thanks very much for joining FEBS in these difficult times.
Well, thank you, Laszlo. I much appreciate it. I should say one thing, that the sort of background in theory helped me enormously when it came to thinking about practice. I'm surprised myself, in fact.
Well, indeed. And I think in our conversation, we can touch both sides, a little bit of theory, and also pretty much the practice and the current political situation. But let me start with something personal, because it might be that last time we met in New York City, and you are a New Yorker. And now, after a very long time, there is a president of the United States who is from New York. And at least ostensibly, he's someone who is trying to promote peace. So my first question would be, how do you see the rise of Donald Trump as a president? And how do you assess his initiatives for peace in the recent period? How genuine it is?
Well, the first thing I would say, as sort of an ex-New Yorker, I live across the bridge now in the town of Fort Lee, New Jersey, the home of film, if I may say so, not Hollywood. How would I assess President Trump? He's, first of all, a real estate person. Without understanding that, it's very difficult to understand Donald Trump, I think, because this is the key to his idea of what's transactional and his idea of making deals, the art of the deal, as it's known. Very often, the art of the deal comes down to this. I build a building. I order cement from you for $50. You give me the cement, I build my building, you come to me and say, well, where's my $50? And I'll say, nowhere. Sue me. And that's exactly what the person will do. And then I will come back to the person and say, or Trump will come back to the person and say, look, this can go on for 5 years. Instead of $50, I'm going to offer you $10. You want it, and very often the person will take it. This is one of the key elements to Trump's policy, is the use of litigation, the use of loopholes to try and get his way. I think he's the first president who's done it this way, and with such consistency. By the way, in terms of foreign policy, the deal that he has offered Ukraine about sharing the minerals is exactly this kind of deal. In other words, first we invest, then the minerals come out, then the United States pays for the minerals. And there's the, or it's share of the minerals. And the full share is not going to be coming. Hmm.
Well, I think you are already zooming on the critical question of this period, which is the war in Ukraine, and whether after 3 years and a half, we are getting closer to an end of this. And since the Alaska summit, when the two presidents met, the president of Russia and the United States, I think people may have an expectation that something would be forced upon Ukraine. But as it looks currently, this would be quite horrible end. So is the choice today between the continuation of the horror or a horrible end, or is there something else too?
Well, I think that there are various suggestions which can be made with regard to the future. And these I tried to develop in both some of my writings and in the work for that's been done for ICDD USA. And it would seem to me that the way to begin, what can be done, what are the suggestions I would offer? It seems to me this. We would, first of all, like to see the seizure of the $300 billion in Russian assets. That's one, I think, unconditional necessity, because if we're going to talk about an end to the war, if that's going to be taken as crucial, then what happens after the war is connected to that. We have to have a theory of how Ukraine is rebuilt. And it would seem to me that this is a way to start. The second thing it would seem to me is crucial is some kind of collective security for both sides. I know this sounds like equivalence, but I think it's not. And I think it's not because this is not just an ideological demand, President Putin, but a longstanding geopolitical one. And as surely as it is that President Putin wishes to recreate the old Russian Empire, so surely is it that paranoia towards the West exists. For right or wrong is not the issue. The reality is we need some kind of security guarantees that will allow President Putin an exit strategy from this war that he can sell to his own people. What is that? In the first instance, I think it means NATO making the statement that it's not going to expand. I don't think there's any choice in that. The second thing I believe that is important, or what might be introduced into the discussion, is a kind of no man's land between the two nations. Although this is often derided, I think it's important. This is not a new idea. It's been raised in various crisis situations, and I think it would be appropriate here. The other thing is, I believe that some kind of international monitoring is necessary. Now, the question is, who does or which nations engage in the monitoring? One of the reasons Putin has been so adamant in rejecting the idea of international monitoring is because it's not clear who's going to do it. If neutral countries could be brought into the discourse, this might be a start, at least a start for discussing some kind of monitoring for the situation. I think also there would be a way for a kind of compromise, which perhaps could have been taken at the beginning of the war. Much has been said about the need for Ukraine to enter NATO formally. I think perhaps we might go back to what was on the table just before the war began, which is basically Ukraine enters the economic structure of the EU as a full member, but it withholds or withdraws the demand for membership in NATO. We would then have a situation where de facto a kind of security degree is given to Ukraine without bringing NATO into the picture. Now, I want to be clear, because this is often misunderstood with our position, the position of ICDD and our independent experts peace initiative. We are not saying, and certainly I'm not saying, that the conditions in Ukraine and Russia are the same. But I am saying that Ukraine is going to have to make concessions. I don't think there's any question about it. And I think they're going to be substantive. Secondly, I think it's fair to talk about the need for elections, for an extension of civil liberties to various minorities, precisely because there's a war situation. I would say the same thing in the United States. This is not a disloyalty or lack of solidarity. Real solidarity means there has to be an open conversation between allies.
You have given a lot of details about perhaps a peace vision. Do you base this on some previous experience? Is there a comparator of this war, or is there a kind of peacemaking experience from the past which can inspire all these approaches which you explained?
You asked the most sort of difficult question, Laszlo, I must say. I'm not one who believes that history repeats itself, that those who don't know history are condemned to repeat it. Often those who know history make the biggest mistakes. A case in point would be belief in the dominoes theory with regard to Vietnam. The discussion about appeasement that is floating all over Europe, that discussion also came up when during the Vietnam War in the United States. Do we appease the worldwide spread of communism, or do we stand up against it in Vietnam? I don't think the closest conflict that I see here is in a certain way Ireland with regard to England. And that was a conflict that went on, as you know, forever. We have Ireland in a certain way split between Northern Ireland and the rest of the country, de facto. And the relation to England is very difficult. Let me put it this way. We're going to be in a situation where I think if we talk in terms of appeasement, it's easy to say, don't appease, be absolutely stubborn. If you're ready to do certain things, and if we think back to 1938 in Munich, where, of course, Czechoslovakia, here we can see parallels, right? A deal was made in 1938, an attempt to preserve peace, which led Prime Minister Daladier and Prime Minister Churchill and Mussolini to meet with Hitler. The discussion was a very similar set of dubious claims. Hitler suggested there were Germans in the Sudetenland who wished to become part of Germany and whose rights were being denied. Very similar, a specious claim is made by President Putin, of course, with regard to Crimea and the Russian population. And at this conference, strangely enough, two things were also similar. One, Czechoslovakia was not invited to the peace talks, just as Ukraine was not invited to the original peace talks or the Alaska summit. And two, the great power on the continent was excluded, and that was the Soviet Union. Here, Russia is excluded, but also China and India. In my opinion, with respect to beginning to a summit, with respect to fostering a, shall we say, a serious collective security arrangement, those nations are going to have to be included. I want to add one other thing. If I can say so, for once, I got something right. I did an article. This was about a year ago. I said that the best way to proceed was to include BRICS nations, in other words, especially India and China, into the negotiations directly with Russia and Ukraine. And I suggested that the move that President Trump should make is to try and do the best he can to disrupt the alliance that exists between Russia, India, and China. Weirdly enough, he has done exactly the opposite. What should have been an attempt to divide Russia from China has actually brought Russia closer to China. What might have been a move to, distance oneself from a pretty horrible regime led by the leader of India and President Xi of China. The attempt to divide them has brought them, what should have been an attempt to divide them was exactly, resulted in exactly the opposite, much in large part through this completely incomprehensible tariff policy that President Trump has engaged. What's clear is that President Trump's policy has essentially resulted in a kind of economic war between China and the United States. This was completely unnecessary. The demand to raise tariffs 50% on nations that do business with with Russia, will obviously draw India, China, even Iran, and other such countries together. I mean, it only makes sense. What I believe was so tragic with President Trump's policy here was that divisions could have been furthered between these nations with a more appropriate diplomatic policy. But Trump, for his own reasons, didn't want to.
I see the point. You used the possibility to compare the current situation with World War II. I think in the last 3 years and a half, most analysts somehow referred back to the problem of aggression and negotiating the bad type of peace, which eventually led to war again. I wonder if you find a relevant comparison with what happened in the post-Yugoslav space 30 years ago. This is also the 30th yes. anniversary of the so-called Dayton Agreement, in which the United States yes. of America, a very distinguished diplomat, Richard Holbrooke, actually negotiated a certain type of peace, which probably very few people liked at the time, very few people like now, but for 30 years at least, it has brought an end of the bloodshed. What do you think about this, especially from a U.S. point of view, a U.S. approach to making peace in our region?
Let me say something that I think most commentators or analysts hardly ever say, which is I'm no expert on Bosnia. So what I say you should take with a grain of salt. I'm always honest about this kind of stuff. In my opinion, first of all, there was an acceptance of the United States sort of entering the negotiating scene And there was a desire to do so. The United States was not following a neo-isolationist policy, which it is today. Secondly, there was, in a certain way, a kind of equidistant relationship between the United States and the different combatants. That doesn't seem to me the case with regard, especially with regard now, the favoritism that President Trump has shown to President Trump. Thirdly, I think it's going to be, this question of monitoring is going to come into play. Mr. Holbrook sort of used this as his signature approach, or as a singular tactic, which made sense since he was able basically to get all nations, all participants to agree that monitoring, especially by the United States forces, many of whom are still there, was a realistic possibility. If that monitoring by the United States neither is not acceptable to participants, or monitoring by NATO or EU states, if that's not acceptable, that's not going to work, I think.
I see the point.
How should I say, the attitudinal ground has shifted, if I can put it this way. I don't think the American constituency is willing to accept sort of an endless engagement here. Because I mean, I'm no expert, but this is just from what I know. The tensions in Yugoslavia, in the former Yugoslavia, are still real. They still have to be tempered by external forces. Could be wrong on this, but this is sort of what I've picked up. I don't think that's going to work. I think that we have to use, as not an example of peace, but an example of problems. I think we have to go back to Munich, and particularly in this regard. And as the Secretary General of one of the most important advisory bodies with regard to Europe, I'm going to throw this back to you. Let's say, just hypothetically, we make the deal. Ukraine makes the deal and says, okay, we'll hand over parts of Donbas, parts of and Crimea, and Putin for the moment says, I will give up the demands of the territories that I don't yet control. Purely hypothetical. Because that's basically what happened at in Munich. Hitler said, this will be my last demand. I will make, I have no designs on the rest of Czechoslovakia. And of course, you see how that turned out. Now, what happens if we get the deal, right? And Putin takes the concessions and then tries to gobble up the rest of Ukraine. What do we do then?
Well, I'm afraid this is an argument against any concession, right? So now I think for some time, people have been calibrating, okay, what is a reasonable concession? But at some point you arrive to the conclusion that this concession can be reasonable.
At the same time, you can't simply start with that assumption, right, as a proponent of peace. So what you want to try and do is be very cautious and be very clear about how you build up a deterrent. I mean, that's all that can be done, of course.
Can I ask you about your expert community? Because recently you organized a conference in Portugal, about war and peace and security. And you brought together experts from many different countries who probably never met before. And what is your experience about this very diverse thinking about the questions of war and peace, and specifically right. in the context of the, Ukraine?
We call it the Independent Experts Peace Initiatives, which was put together by, or better, which is a network that was organized of intellectuals and experts, intellectual experts and activist experts on a particular region and conflict. That was, of course, Russia-Ukraine. This has been a pretty controversial product that we put out, which was a white paper. The way we put together the white paper was as follows. Valerie Engel, myself, and one or two other people put together a large questionnaire. And we chose 25 people from different countries, purposefully with different standpoints. This was done on purpose. And we asked them to provide answers, not just yes or no, but detailed answers, which they did, surprisingly. We received responses of 20 pages of, or the like, from most of the respondents. Then we collated the results and put forward a document, basically, that no one could agree with fully, but that tried to integrate the standpoint of others. Our concern was to provide scenarios and options in dealing with those scenarios. This has nothing, it had nothing to do with setting up equivalence between Russia and Ukraine. It was not the usual academic paper which says, well, I believe this, you listen to me, otherwise you're an idiot. This was an attempt to sort of open a dialogue and perhaps advise and help decision makers. We know they're making the decisions, not us. But we have to be willing to give them the appropriate scenarios. And that's what we tried to do. Now, with regard to what is the appropriate steps towards, what are the appropriate steps towards peace, we have to ask intermediate or ultimate. What is it we ultimately want to secure peace? Absolutely. What can we introduce to get some kind of temporary cessation of what is a genocidal situation? And it seems to me that there are, on the broader level, I'm just going to give you some general suggestions. What I mentioned, which is to create some type of collective security system for all the players. Now, that security system may require, I say may require, a kind of new Yalta from 1945. As you know, what Yalta did was set up basically spheres of influence between the Soviet Union and the Western allies. It set the conditions for a new Cold War. At the moment, a new Cold War would be an extraordinary improvement over the situation that exists at present, especially for the Ukrainian people. And I think this is something we have to explore. I'm not saying I support it 100%. I'm not even 100% sure of what the boundaries would be at Yalta, especially after the war. It was clear what the boundaries were. The boundaries were when the armies stopped. Yeah. We can't use that as the boundary anymore because many of the claims, especially those made by President Putin, are for areas that Russia doesn't control. But I think the idea is that some type of security arrangement on this style is going to be necessary, if not de jure, then de facto. I think this is also going to mean that there are going to be red lines that can't be crossed.
Stephen, you mentioned Yalta, and I think for having a full picture, I think it's important to say that there was, on the one hand, indeed a decision about Germany, how to occupy Germany between the victorious powers. On the other hand, at the same time, they decided about the establishment of the United Nations, which means to create a multilateral system in which everybody would be at some point included. Not everybody was included immediately in the United Nations system, but slowly, the puzzle became full. And maybe that's also a necessity, when we think about this, not simply about, dominance and influences, but also what happens to the grand total, right? What happens to...
I think that's exactly right, Laszlo. And I think actually there's sort of a transition that can be made. If the negotiation table is open to Ukraine, Russia, the United States, European Union, China, India, in other words, all the direct and indirect participants, it's tough to negotiate in that way. If the negotiation process were set up in that way, the foundation would be laid for the kind of transnational.
Can I come back to your expert group, which you brought together? I wonder how deeply the question of culture and understanding came up when discussing peace, because probably peace is also a matter of culture, mutual understanding, reconciliation. And I was wondering whether you give any significance to the endeavor to prevent wars, right? So it's not simply to end existing war, end ongoing wars, but also to invest in the prevention of violence and interstate wars.
That's the primary thing, in fact. For us, or for me, this is absolutely primary. It's the prevention. Even Kant once said there would never be perpetual peace. It only provides a kind of regulative ideal for activities taken in the name of peace. The culture thing is very interesting, and I will be honest about it, even though I guess both sides that I mention here will disagree and be shocked. I think for people on the far left, for people who are like myself, who went through the Vietnam era in the United States, and who saw the kind of imperialist policies that were carried on by Nixon, by Reagan, by Bush, and then later. It's very hard to analyze a situation where the United States isn't a villain. It's an embarrassing thing to say, but I think it's true. On the other hand, from those who are simply, legitimately shocked by the genocide or quasi-genocide of those who are suffering bombings from Russia, there is almost a kind of Russophobic aspect to their analyses. In a certain way, both sides have a point, right? But the Russophobia gets in the way of trying to prevent further conflict. The goal, I think, we have, the challenge that's in front of us, is how do we take issues which are so ideologically charged and move them to a basis where material interests become clear and exit strategies are given, both sides. And it becomes possible to be, I can put it this way, more instrumental and realistic in getting some kind of solution.
Yes.
The problem is ideology is always tough to compromise. Material interests are, I wouldn't say easy, but easier.
Easier.
Yeah, that's how I Indeed. Would, that's how I would view this.
Stephen, we have talked a lot about Ukraine, and obviously this is very much in the center of the interest of many of us. At the same time, you mentioned Ireland, I mentioned Bosnia, but there is one other war which we must mention, because without this, our conversation would not be complete, and that's the situation in Gaza. Why do you think the Europeans focus so much on Ukraine and somehow appear to be either ignorant or even irresponsible concerning the situation in Gaza?
Well, I think one reason is, as complicated as Ukraine and Russia, the conflict between them is, and as intransigent as the two sides are, it's much worse in Palestine and Israel. And also, of course, the second part is another reason is, it's less immediate. There's less of an existential threat involved for Europe with regard to Gaza than there is, I should say, Russian imperialism. It's just a more real threat to them, more immediate threat to European nations, excuse me, than what happens in Gaza and Palestine. Which has another dimension, namely, Ukraine and Russia are major powers in their own way, or maybe not so much Ukraine, but the point is major powers have pulled into this. That's not the case here. It's important for the Middle East, but these are just not of global military significance in the way that, or geopolitical significance in the way that the Eastern conflict is. I mean, if this goes wrong in Ukraine, we're talking about Lithuania, Latvia, Moldova, all these nations coming under threat, Georgia, Azerbaijan, Armenia. This is a quasi-global issue. That's less so in the Middle East. Also, the complexity of this is very difficult. Let me give an example of what's not discussed of this complexity. And I find it absolutely amazing. I think most of us, not all of us, but most of us on the outside would like to see a two-state solution. I think most Israelis, or at least half the Israeli population, and many in Palestine would like to see that. Let's say, for argument's sake, we could overcome the complete fragmentation of the Palestinian territory. There are blockades everywhere. In order to go 2 miles, some Palestinians may take them hours to navigate the different blockades, barbed wire, cement blocks, and so on. Now, let's say, hypothetically, all this was overcome. Now, what happens then? You can have two states. First, there's going to be unquestionably a fifth column involved in both states. We'll bracket that. Yeah. Take the next step. There are now, depending upon how you count, anywhere from 250 to 700,000 settlers in the West Bank. and they're armed. Now, let's just say that, for argument's sake, Netanyahu says today, time for a two-state solution. Why does everybody assume that these settlers will simply agree to it and lay down their arms? This is, among Jews, there's an old saying, Jew doesn't shoot against Jew. I don't believe that's true anymore. I see the possibility for a civil war within what remains of the Israeli state. On the other hand, why does one believe that the interests of Fatah and Hamas are those of the Palestinian people, or dozens in particular? Let's say they get the Palestinians get a state. Gaza will then undoubtedly be the minority. Will it accept that, especially if it's armed? Debatable, at best.
Yes.
Maybe a civil war there too.
I think the way you explain it raises the big dilemma between whether going for minimum and maximum, because in this context, obviously, an elementary minimum would be to provide humanitarian aid to Gaza to stop the ethnic cleansing. And of course, the maximum, I very much agree with the point that even if it's distant from the rabbin times, but to revive the notion of the two-state solution somehow, would at least need to inspire the attempts to solve
the conflict. But I think it's fair to say we need a little more substance to the idea of a two-state solution. I haven't really spoken to anyone. You're better connected perhaps than I am in this stuff. But I haven't spoken to anyone who has anything more to say about a two-state solution than abstractions. If you make the argument, and of course I agree, we need the immediate need is for a ceasefire. And it would seem to me that President Trump could stop arms sales to Israel.
And many others too.
Yeah.
And the Europeans too.
They could do that. Of course, I support aid. I support airlifts and whatever people can. This is where the technical aspects. But why is there this assumption that Hamas actually wants to improve the situation of Gaza? The more, and there's an argument to be made that the worse conditions get for the people of Gaza, the more they will rally around the government that claims to represent them. There's so much in that's not clear here. And if we simply get the ceasefire, simply get aid sent over, we're right back where we began. We've had close to 70,000 people killed, the entire infrastructure of Gaza destroyed, arguments about possibilities of depopulation manifest, and Israel turned even more into a pariah than it was. This is not exactly a, shall we say, a happy solution. I think we have to start with the assumption with Gaza, not with nonsense like from the, up to the sea, basically the creation of one state. That's not going to happen. We have to start with the assumption that there are going to be two losers in this war. And that's the cultural,
like in other cases.
That's the cultural obstacle that is going to be very difficult to overcome. As much as
definitely, yes. No, what I was thinking about is that from a European perspective, it's important to understand that the complexity of the maximum goals should not be an excuse for not doing the minimum.
That is,
and probably a lot of the European states and the European Union itself is not doing the bare minimum, which would be necessary in this region.
I couldn't agree more. That's certainly true.
Look, thank you so much for all these thoughts. I think we could continue because there have been so many wars, so many conflicts, but there are always good peace efforts as well.
Mm-hmm.
And I think sometimes, even if it's the suboptimal arrangement which settles a conflict, I think if we want to settle conflicts, there must be an open mind.
Indeed.
To search for it, and probably in an inclusive fashion.
Yes, indeed. And I hope that, I was going to say to you, I hope that FEPS and ICDD USA can perhaps work together on some joint conferences or discussions that will bring politicians, media people, and the like together. That would be great if we could do that. Certainly think.
Well, indeed, the problem remains on the table for some time. I think it's going to be a long peace process, if we are in a peace process at all. And I look forward to many other conversations and cooperations with you on this subject.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much for your time.
Great pleasure, as always. Bye-bye.